Welcome to David Maister's Business Masterclass, a series of advanced business seminars exploring principles and practices for success in professional businesses.
Hello, I'm David Maister. In this seminar entitled Competing Through Effective Organizations, the 12th part in my 14-part series on strategy and professional businesses, I'm going to discuss an article I wrote with Patrick McKenna. I'll try to make the case that most strategy today requires the ability to make complex organizations function smoothly. It's essential, but it's rarely done well. When one reviews the topics we have covered in this podcast series, values, collaboration, being a one-firm firm, achieving success not by having better ideas than the next person, but by operating across the firm with greater diligence and consistency, it might reasonably be said that in professional businesses, the organization's functioning is the strategy. If it functions smoothly, the firm will excel. If it creates barriers or stumbles, the firm will be only mediocre. Professional businesses today are structurally complex organizations with both management and those in client-serving roles overburdened by time-consuming and often conflicting roles. Patrick and I frequently hear from members of management comments like, "We have a number of departments in this firm, divided into many more practice groups." Overlaying that, we also have industry groups dedicated to developing a better knowledge of and marketing to specific industries. Then we have numerous client teams aiming at coordinating the many services we provide to our best clients. All of these departments, practice groups, industry groups, and client teams are then organized across geographic locations, some of them in different countries. It's not at all clear what each of these groupings should be responsible for and how their activities should be coordinated and evaluated. And then individual partners weigh in with their perspective. For example, someone might say, "As a trial lawyer, I'm first and foremost a member of the litigation department, but because most of my litigation experience is with employment matters, I'm a member of the labor and employment practice group. And as I have a good amount of work with Walmart and McDonald's, I'm active on those two client teams, and also, as a result, on the firm's retail industry team." And then finally, from a managing partner, you might hear, "If you are a key player in this firm, you can spend an inordinate amount of time in meetings. I participate in no less than 10 meetings a month myself. There's got to be a better way to organize our firm for effective operations." Well, there is, but the way many firms organize and manage has not kept up with their increasing complexity as businesses. Eventually, we think sooner rather than later, this will significantly impede their continuing success. Not only do modern firms have more types of organizational groups than in the past, but the individual groups nowadays have the responsibility to do more than what they used to do. In the past, their job was to generate business and do the work. But to survive and flourish today, individual groups within the firm must worry about client loyalty, knowledge transfer, development of their people, junior and senior, deployment of technology, and many other balanced scorecard items. To make it all worse, many of today's groups will be composed of people who, because of geographic dispersion, do not see each other regularly face-to-face or perhaps at all. They have to operate as members of a virtual organization and sometimes wouldn't even recognize a fellow team member. All of this has introduced some novel questions into the firm management discussions we now hear in boardrooms across the country and around the world. How do we go about deciding how critical and limited resources are best distributed among the competing groups and new initiatives? How do we organize our groups around the industries? Do we serve all industries or do we focus on a few? What guidelines should we have to handle those of our clients that fall into more than one industry group? How do we compile and share best practices between and among the professionals in all of these various groups? And then a very serious problem for some firm members, how do our firms support professionals in marketing, HR, IT? How do they divide their time effectively among the various groups in order to provide the required assistance? Now, I'm not going to suggest, and Patrick would not suggest, that we have answers to all of these complex issues that would fit every firm's situation. However, we do offer five perspectives that we think would guide any review of a firm's structure. Imperative number one, examine all of your structure, your processes, and your people. We would first observe that the solution for any individual firm must always address the three aspects of any organization: its structure, how they are organized, the boxes on the page; the processes, how different types of decisions are made; and then finally, choosing the right people, making sure that we make selections of the right people to play the complex roles that will make it all work. No one dimension will solve the problem. All three must be examined in any review. Imperative number two, recognize shifting priorities in structural design. Structural change alone will not resolve conflicting priorities and competing demands for resources. But structure does nevertheless matter. The evolution of professional service firms over time is suggesting that some structural approaches do work better than others. Most successful global firms in a broad array of professions have tilted the importance of their different organizational axes, and corporations of all kinds are following the same path. While individual differences between industries and firms exist, the general trend in most firms and companies are these. Most important and most organizationally powerful in most companies today is the target client industry. Clients are repeatedly telling their professional service providers, their product providers, that they, the provider, had better get to know and understand their business. Nowadays, the phrase vertical is very common in business discussions, and it means focusing on your client's industry. Next, in authority and emphasis, comes the specifically targeted client team. Our examination from the client's perspective shows that more and more sophisticated client companies give minimal credibility to large companies who claim to provide seamless service across jurisdictions. Well-orchestrated client teams are the only answer to making any seamless service representation a reality, organizing around clients. Third, and with increasingly less power and responsibility inside most companies, are the discipline or service line groups, those built around a focused technical specialty or skill. Firms need to have focused and skilled technical people, but few in most industries are still primarily organized that way. Finally, and this is a huge revolution from the past, the trend has been to make geography the least important and powerful dimension of the complex matrix. In the past, the office head or the country head in mega firms was the source of all resources and the arbiter of last resort. Today, in many companies, an office head or a country head may preside over a location where all the key people belong to groups headed and controlled by powerful people located elsewhere. Imperative number three, establish mandates separately for each of the groups. Even if you have an ideal structure, there will always be problems with coordinating cross-boundary resources and dealing with conflicting priorities. You simply cannot make all cross-boundary issues go away by simply redesigning boundaries. Beyond structure, firms must ensure that each group has a clear mission or mandate, which is understood by those inside the group and also well understood by those outside the group. It's apparently tempting, if our experience is any guide, for companies and firms to launch groups of different kinds, you be our industry team or you be our client team, with very ambiguous charters. And the actual way in which different teams intersect is left up to negotiations in real time for powerful or not so powerful group leaders to determine precisely how it will unfold. Our experience is that this abdication of examining the intersections and the overlaps of different groups, abdicating the issue of exploring it in advance, may lead to a smoothly functioning organization. You could argue that evolution is a good thing, but the risks of the opposite are high. As difficult as it can be to negotiate group goals and to establish guidelines for how groups will interact, we believe it's essential that such a discussion and resolution take place. Now, Patrick McKenna and I have discussed specific procedures for addressing and resolving these questions in our book, First Among Equals, published in 2002. However, in our experience, these mandates or missions are often still poorly specified and frequently too grandiose. Many groups choose too many goals, and you probably know the old rule, too many goals imply no goals. It is this lack of clarity that causes many, many of the problems of complex organizations. It's okay to have teams of different kinds, but you need to know in advance what it is you want them to do. We also believe that different groups can have their own very customized set of objectives, and that firms must stop treating all groups alike, which many unfortunately do for administrative convenience. It is possible to use different types of groups for different things. Lots of little teams for client-level relationships, one large central group for finance and administration. A large, growing, and complex firm doesn't have to be, in fact can't be, made up of units which have similar roles, look alike, have the same targets, are set of the same size, and are managed in the same way. In making all of this work, it is better to stop thinking of hard, permanent departments written down in ink on the page and begin to think about using semi-permanent teams. There is a great deal of evidence from business and from other authors that organizations work better when three things occur. A, people feel like volunteers. B, they volunteer to small teams. And C, they volunteer to small, mission-oriented teams. This is not just a matter of making people feel good. It has always been true that winning in professional businesses succeeds most by designing an organization from the bottom up, by creating and building it upon the voluntary enthusiasm of individuals. You'll be better off designing your organization from the bottom up, creating a messy set of teams filled with enthusiasts who want to be on that team, than you will by designing a logically correct set of groups filled with good citizens. If you have to assign somebody to a group, you've lost a high percentage of your effectiveness. Imperative number four, clarify agreements within the groups. Firms can successfully have many teams of different kinds, but there needs to be a clear understanding of what team membership implies. As a matter of practicality, although not alas in reality in some companies, there needs to be a limit on the number of teams and the number of roles that one person can play. You have to enforce that rule. For teams to work, there need to be clearer, more explicit guidelines, even written down rules of engagement that team members have agreed to observe. Clarifying team members' rights and obligations and writing them down can go a long way to becoming more efficient and effective. Even as simple as a rule as, you must do what you said you were going to do, would transform some firms and save a lot of wasted meeting and planning time. Part of the solution may involve thinking of and formalizing different levels of team membership. For example, levels of team membership might include full decision rights, possibly called team leadership, with the next level being the right to be consulted, called team membership, or a lower level called the right to be kept informed, called team affiliation. These are just examples. But the key idea here is make sure that people understand their rights and obligations, perhaps at different levels of what it means to be part of the team. Finally, imperative five, choose the right group leaders. A key to making any organizational structure work is making sure that the firm appoints or develops people with the right characteristics to perform team leadership roles. People are much more important than any structure or process. This was always true, but it's even more critical in today's world. Consider some of the skills, perhaps newly important, that today's group leader probably must have. the ability and interest in motivating and influence people that they never see in person. The ability to delegate and trust others to manage important relationships. The ability to manage people who have core disciplines and skills other than the one in which the leader was specifically trained. The ability to play a linking pin role, simultaneously thinking not only about the unit which he or she heads, but simultaneously worrying about the overall good of the firm. In our experience, many firms have not really thought through the requirements of today's leadership role. It's a common syndrome that all initiatives, client teams, industry, geographic, functional, etc., they're all seen as important, so the same powerful people always end up on all of the committees. As a result, it becomes somewhat hit and miss as to whether the right people get selected for these roles. It's hit or miss about whether their mandate is clear, whether their performance as leaders is discussed and evaluated, and whether or not they receive any guidance or assistance in learning how to perform the role. Not only does this hurt the firm by possibly leading to less effective team leadership, but it's not clear that it's wise to consume the scarce time of valuable people by asking them to manage and/or get involved in everything. This is simple economics. A valuable resource should always be focused on its highest and best use. Of course, to make this work, there would be a need for key players to be willing to let other people play a managerial role, to let other people decide some things even when they're not there. And some firms and companies don't yet have that culture. We don't mean this to be a throwaway line. To effect real change, firms must not try to establish theoretically correct structures and processes. There is no such thing. Because of the importance of people in making it work, firms must design their organization around what their people will accept. They must have honest discussions amongst powerful senior people about the types and nature of the firm's group processes that would, in fact, be honored. We've seen too many companies and firms go through the motions of putting in place what appear to be sensible organizations when everyone knows that certain key partners will not adhere to the policies that have been adopted. We're not idealists here. We recognize the realities of the need to accommodate personalities and special situations. But Patrick and I do not believe that progress is made by pretending or obtaining false consent. That's why organizational solutions must be custom designed for each firm and need to be the result of a comprehensive review, not, as is so frequently the case, the net result of an accumulation of a series of incremental changes driven by short-term pressures. Now, I don't want to go from the sublime down to the ridiculous, but I really ought to address in this seminar the fact that there are some very seemingly low-level topics which are critical in making the organization work. One is quite simply beginning to adopt some sensible meeting rules. Let me take a really trivial topic, the rule that says you shouldn't have a meeting that doesn't have a goal. Most meetings in most firms have agendas but no goals. And the simple culture of running meetings so that we are mission-oriented can make large, complex organizations work much better. A trivial topic, but very powerful. Similarly, there is so much to say about today's technologies in making all of this work. There is the relevance of wikis and jams and internal blogs and internal deal rooms. And I don't have space to talk about them in this particular seminar. All I want to acknowledge is that those tools are incredibly valuable if the issues I've addressed in this seminar are first explored. The tools themselves will not help if we haven't addressed the issues that this seminar has tried to raise. This concludes Competing Through Effective Organizations, the 12th episode in my 14-part series, Strategy in Professional Businesses. The last two episodes will offer a quick start program for strategy and a summary of what kind of manager it takes to create a strategic organization. Today's seminar was based on an article co-authored with Patrick McKenna and can be found on my website at davidmaester.com. This podcast series is now available for purchase, both as a single episode and as part of a DVD set, from my website, davidmaister.com/store, STORE. I'm also pleased to announce that my forthcoming book, Strategy and the Fat Smoker, is available for pre-order from this same location.